Hi, I'm Jenny Radelet, producer of The Treatment, and we've got a special bonus podcast for you today with actor Bruce Dern. He has a lot of stories to tell, and he gets to almost all of them in the following conversation with Elvis Mitchell after a screening of his latest film, Nebraska. He plays Woody Grant, an elderly father who takes a trip to Nebraska with his son, played by Will Forte, to claim a $1 million prize from a mail-in sweepstakes. The performance garnered him an Oscar nomination for Best Actor. He talks about his beginnings at the Actors Studio in New York, studying with Elia Kazan, working with Alfred Hitchcock in the 60s, and his first Oscar nomination in 1979 for Hal Ashby's Coming Home. He also talks about waiting 10 years for Alexander Payne to give him the role of a lifetime and why he's not planning on slowing down anytime soon. This conversation was taped in front of a live audience as part of the Film Independent at LACMA screening series. Just a heads up, this conversation contains explicit language.
So, I was asking you backstage what Cannes was like, and you were telling me.
Well, of all the things that I'm a sports gambler, and I've seen eruptions, but the most immediate eruption I've ever seen in my life was for this movie at Cannes. And that's a big gym. There's about 2,000 people in there. And they laughed, they liked it, but the immediacy, they were on their feet right away, they liked it, and Alexander poked at me and he says, "Bruce, the Frenchies get it." Imagine what could happen when we get back to Iowa. So that was pretty wonderful. I mean, it was very, very cool, and they applauded for a long time. And we didn't know. You know, I mean, 10 years ago, last month, I saw the script for the first time. And it wasn't sent to me with an offer to do it or anything else. It was just sent to me, "What do you think?" And the next morning, I went to Toys R Us as quick as I could, and I bought him a little red truck. I put a note in it saying, "I'm Woody," and didn't hear from some bitch for 5 years. I mean, I pick up a trade one day and I read he's going to do a movie in a wine country, you know, with some people and called Sideways. And then I figure, well, now maybe. And then I read he's going to Hawaii to make The Descendants. And immediately, with my unbelievable, lack of faith in myself, I knew that I was a problem, and that's why they weren't making the movie. I also knew there was a problem because he refused to make it if he couldn't make it in black and white. Eventually, he won the battle for me, but up until we started in October of last year, well, year before last, 2012. And 60 days before we started, he was still not allowed to make it in black and white. And so he was going to walk away from it, I'm sure. And what happened was the Oscar was won by that movie with the little dog in it, you know, whatever that was called, which was black and white, and The Descendants did very, very well. And finally, Paramount, mainly because of Brad Grey and Adam Goodman, said, "You know, you have Alexander Payne. Let the man make his movie." So that was it, and then we started, and it was wonderful. I mean, the most fabulous, you know, I've been very lucky this year. I've won some awards. I've been nominated for a bunch of awards. But the biggest win I'll ever have in my career is the guy gave me the role. And that was a once-in-a-lifetime.
What was your first conversation with him like when you sat down to talk about the script?
Well, he had me in the year before he did it, he said, "Well, I'm finally getting around to it now. And what do you think?" And I told him in the letter. The letter wasn't just a postcard. It was a couple of pages. And
what did you say in the letter?
Huh?
What did you say in the letter? Do you remember?
Yeah, I basically said, "I see it. you see it all. I get it. You get it all. If you'll take my hand, we could go down and maybe do some magical shit here. And he was excited about that, but then 3 months later, I read that there were conversations with Gene Hackman. So I said, well, you know, here we go. And I don't know. Gene Hackman was retired and didn't want to do it, and I don't know how much Alexander really wanted him, but that was something that I guess pressure was put on him, whatever the point was. But Gene Hackman was retired and didn't do it, and the movie fell apart. And the following May, he called me. I was, I don't know if you all remember Jean-Pierre Bujold, but she and I were doing a little movie in Vermont. And they called me and they said, it was like, I don't know, a Monday. And they called me and they said, can you be in Alexander Payne's office this Friday? And I said, I have 11 days to go here. He says, well, can you talk to the powers? So I said, well, I'll give it a try. So in the last 4 days that I was there, they shot 11 of my scenes, which tickled Genevieve to death. You know, you've never seen a woman more pissed off in your life. And she's absolutely a beautiful dame. I don't know if you remember, she was a girl at her first movie. She was nominated for an Academy Award for a movie called Anne of a Thousand Days with Richard Burton, where she played Anne Boleyn. And then did a movie with Jeremy Irons called Dead Ringers, where he played two people.
She's also
and
in Coma.
Yeah, and right. Has hair to her butt at 75 years old. And she's a Quebecois, and meaning that Canada's out and French Canada's in, and get it or leave. And very opinionated. And so she did the work, cooperated, and when she saw the movie, was one of the first to respond really overtly to the movie and to me and everything else. And I went into Alexander's office, and you know, actors shouldn't tell these stories, but I'm hoping there's a lot of actors out there and they'll understand. In the center of his room, I was the only person there. And John Jackson, his casting director, who's responsible for a lot of these faces and stuff you see on the screen. And has cast all Alexander's movies. And he said, there was a camera in the middle of the floor. And I sat down, pretended like it wasn't there, and then finally he said, well, what do you think? I said, that is out. He said, well, let me tell you something. I agree. I don't have a problem with you, but it helps me with the studio. Well, after my 10-year history, or 9 years at that time, after hearing Hackman, after I thought that it was, and so forth and so on, I said, okay. So we just sat down, and John Jackson and I talked through a couple of scenes, and we stopped, and he was sitting on a couch, and he asked me to come and sit down next to him on the couch. I sat down, and he's very kind of professorial, Alexander, you know, he's got the vest and the little cigarillos or whatever they are, and he looks like he's right out of, Bowdoin or Tufts or some school like that, that you have to take a test to get into. And he said, you know something? He's talking to John Jackson and me. He says, I like to give myself a compliment. 10 years ago, when I first saw this material, because y'all got to remember, he did not write this. Bob Nelson wrote this. When I first saw the material, I had you in mind to play the role. And I'd like you to do my movie. That was it. And it's interesting because there's a girl named Julie Thompson who's one of the producers of this film. She lived in Seattle. Bob Nelson lives in Seattle, although all his people come from Hardington, Nebraska. And he wrote this script, and she and he decided to take it to Albert Berger and Ron Yerxa, who are the producers, and who had just were getting ready to do a movie called Little Miss Sunshine, which won them the Academy Award. And for maybe because of their relationship with Alexander Payne, to find the right young whippersnap director who could direct this piece of material that Alexander could kind of shepherd. And Alexander says, no, that's out of the question. I'm directing the movie myself. And that's how he got in. And I never really knew who did what, except Alexander always said he did very little on the material once he got it. You know, the script I'd gotten 10 years early was the same script with kind of a different ending, but otherwise it was, you know, what it was. And I was overwhelmed. If June were here, she'll tell you she's overwhelmed. Will is still pathetically overwhelmed. I mean, he'll tell you tomorrow, you know, with some, like the NBR award in his hand for best supporting actor, he'll tell you, I don't know how I got it. I don't know how I got here. I don't know why he chose me. And I asked Alexander, I said, "What? One day, why Will Forte?" He said, because a lot of people sent me tapes, and I believed him. And that's why he's in my movie. And when you work with Alexander, we're here. Alexander's close to us as you are. He's not behind a monitor. He's got one of those little Mickey Mouse monitors in his hand. But he's watching you. And he will not print one take if he doesn't believe he's watching it for the first time it's ever happened. So there's very little rehearsal. June and Will and I got there like 5 days before we started shooting. We read through it two times that afternoon and never picked the script up again until the first day of shooting. But in the next 4 days, Alexander, June, me, and Will were driven around by Alexander. We did about 720 miles in 4 days, seeing all these little shitbag towns that he was going to shoot in. And he's all excited about saying, God, will you see this? Will you see the bar and that? And then I walk in, and all the people that you see in the movie, and he hadn't planned this, this was 5 days before, were in those bars. I mean, they're the locals in the bars. And he and John Jackson claimed that they drove in 8 months 20,000 miles all over the state of Nebraska looking for faces. And when they found faces that they wanted, they would say, be here on October 19th, 2012. We're going to use you in the film. Here's a little thing to tell you how to get there. You will get paid. But you're going to be in the movie, and you're going to be characters in the movie. And that's where he got all the people in the bars. And he didn't shoot the exteriors of the bars. He just went and shot those people. And, you know, when you're an actor in my whole career, I mean, I began under contract to Mr. Kazan at the beginning of my career, and I was just quit college. I was kind of a failed runner in 1956, tried to make the Olympic team at 800 meters, wasn't good enough. So I was disillusioned, quit college, went to some little dramatic school in Philadelphia.
And tell them what your parents said when you told them you're going to leave college. What did your parents say?
And after about a month, I realized you had to do three things. You had to go to New York, you had to try and become a member of the Actors Studio, and you had to try to work for Elia Kazan. And I went, and within a couple of months, he put me under contract, having judged my last audition, and said, come on down. And he had four other people. So the five of us were myself, Geraldine Page, Rip Torn, Pat Hingle, and Lee Remick. And I was kind of the baby of the group. They were a little ahead of me and all. And I was excited. And a couple of days, more than a couple of days, with Mr. Hitchcock, not so much on Marnie, because I had a little part.
But you did a TV show. You did Alf Hitchcock Presents. He walked over to you and said, you're extraordinary.
Right. And in Family Plot, there were days that I was excited to go to work every day, but not consecutively. With Alexander Payne, we shot this in 37 days. I went excited to work every single day. And why is that? Because with this guy, every day you think you just might do something that's never been done. And that's what's wonderful about him. And when he's got you surrounded with real people that don't know how to act, and they're dealing with you, you can't perform, you can't act, you have to be real. Of course it's acting. But I mean, and the first day Alexander walked up to me and he said a fabulous thing. He said, "This is Faden Papamichael. He's your cinematographer. You know who I am. I wonder if you might do something for Faden and I that we're not sure you've ever done in your career." "Oh, really? What's that?" He said, "Let us do our jobs." Meaning, he said, "Don't show us anything. Let us find it." That was the key to what you see, not only in my performance, but the whole movie. The guy finds you. You don't have to wait for him to get you or anything else. He's on it. And he see by finding you and being, you know, really in the whole character and everything, you don't have to perform. There's no obligation because suddenly you're on. It's there. And everybody picks up from that. And the guy gives you such fabulous teammates. I mean, look at the teammates I have in this movie. Look at these people. I mean, it's meticulous. And if you sit down, I worked for the director once, who'll go nameless, but who thought that movies were math. And that if you put one next to two, that makes three, and then another three is six. And he'd go all the way through a movie like that. Well, Alexander and Bob Nelson are great at the math, because when you look back at this movie, everything fits. There's nothing that you subtly jump and say, "Oh, that's not part of this movie." You know what I'm saying? He's a tapestry king. And I grew up in Winnetka, Illinois, about 20 miles north of Chicago. I went to New Trier High School. And when I got about 150 miles west of Lake Michigan, you start getting in the heartland of America. And that goes all the way to the Rockies. And there's one thing evident in that heartland. And that's the one thing that Woody is. He's a fair man. And that's what's out there in the heartland. They're fair folks. And irregardless of anything else, they have pride and they're fair. And they believe what folks say, you know.
As you talking about this, though, did he remind you of Kazan? Because it sounds like in some ways Kazan, being part of the Actors Studio and everything, I wonder if it reminded you of that sort of thing where you found
the
character.
Well, he is. I would say that he and Quentin Tarantino are probably the Kazans of right now. How I said I knew I had to go to New York and work for him. I think kids now come to California, kind of put the theater on the back burner, come here earlier probably than maybe they should, but they see reality television, they figure, what the hell? I mean, you know, I may not look like one of the Kardashians, but I'm sure better than two or three of the others. So, I mean, the point is, if they get it for free and they can get in there, how about, I've studied, I'm due out here, but now there's a sense of kids that come here now that we came here to be better actors. And I'm still trying. And the biggest supporter I've had of this film is, Jack Nicholson, who has loved the movie, has been out there for me and the movie, starred in Alexander's third movie about Schmidt, and was an Actor's Studio member like I was, only out here instead of earlier in New York. And what happens is you realize that because of these directors, I don't know how much either one of them loves the acting process, but they realize you have something you have to go through, and they don't fuck with that time. They let you have that time. And it doesn't mean you take up time or anything else, or you prepare or do anything else. You got to be ready when he wants to roll. And when he wants to roll, you give it or you don't. There's no pressure on you because you know he's got your back, and if it's not real, it's not going to be printed. So he's got to believe what he's saying. And that's the magic of it, and the fact that he insists on finding things instead of, you know, you acting for him or showing things. In other words, it's not he doesn't want to see the acting. I think the nicest compliment I had in this movie was I went to a party about a month ago at an actress named Colleen Camp's house, who was, I did a movie called Smile, and in Smile, she was the packer at the beginning of the movie. And she works a lot, and she's very, very neat dame. And I'd never met Al Pacino, and here he was at this party. And he said, God, I hear a lot about this movie and everything. I don't even have a screener yet. Well, Megan Culligan and Adam Goodman, who run the distribution and stuff, and the studio, I went right up and I said, you know, Al Pacino doesn't have a screener. And Adam Goodman turned to Megan Culligan and said, he will have a screener with his breakfast tomorrow morning. Consider it done. And he's talking to Megan, who's in charge of all that. I went back and I said, 2 days later, I got a note from Pacino who said, you did something I've not seen done. You left the acting out and left us with a fabulous human being. And from him, that's big stuff for me, because the man can fucking bring it. Trust me.
Well, you've had quite a couple of years between Alexander and Quentin, who basically crafted a part for you, and like me, has loved you forever. What was that first conversation with Quentin like?
Well, I never met him. I was another one. It was about, he had me come in and meet him for Django, and there was nothing for me to do in the script. He knew it, and I knew it. And he said, you know what, let me think about this. And about a month later, he called Alan Summers, who was my manager, and he said, you know what? I'm going to send Bruce a scene. I want him to be in my movie. So he wrote a scene for me. And it's the scene you see in the movie. And I don't know. I was there 8 days, but I only worked 3 hours, you know, because that was finally got to me. They got to me, and that was it. And it was fabulous because I'm sitting there, and I hadn't done Nebraska yet. And I'm sitting there, and I'm actually watching Gadge. I'm watching Kazan. I mean, he, not language or anything else, but the respect for everyone that was on the set, the respect for the process that everyone had to go through, and his understanding that he also had a job to protect his investors and not go crazy because he's Quentin or Alexander or anything like that. And it was wonderful. But then, I mean, we went to Musso Frank's about one, left about five. But he said to me, I said, what is, you know, what do you want me to do? So I just looked at it and I read it right there. I said, I see it. I get it. I get why you want me. And he says, well, let me tell you the backstory of Django and you. And for 40 minutes, he told me the greatest movie you've ever seen in your life that happens way before Django happens. You know, about the fact that Django was born in the big house. His mother was a cook in my family's big house. She died in childbirth, so Django got to grow up in the big house rather than out in the back of the quarters where the slaves would be. And that's why in that scene, he has me that line where I start out by saying to him, you know, you got a lot of sand, Django. My problem is I just can't use N-words with a lot of game or a lot of sand. So you're going off to do this and that and the other thing. And he just gets it. The exciting thing about my journey right now is, because I have to look beyond this, is I'm always excited in how people will see me after this to ask me to do the next thing that I do. In other words, how will they perceive me now that they see I have a little more game than they might have thought? And
you've always had a lot of game. I mean, one of my favorite performances of yours is this weird little movie called Thumb Tripping.
Oh, my God. Chardoff and Winkler.
That's right.
How about that?
Right.
The guy, Michael Burns. And and then we started with an actress in that movie, excuse the name, Joy Bang. She was the star who had been in Pretty Maids all in a row. And then she got ousted, and in came Meg Foster, who had those eyes, you know, oh my God. The Scarlet Letter, I think she was in later on. But so, you know,
You've always given great performances. You talked about pride. So many of these characters you played have been very proud people.
Oh, yeah.
And that, I think that's one of the great things that you do as an actor. We can always see the pride in these people. I mean, for me, the great tragic character in movies is your character in Coming Home, who's basically, his pride is his downfall. And I think people thought he was a villain. And to me, I thought he was the most tragic figure in the movie.
Oh, it's interesting. I'll tell you a little war story. The end of the movie was not cemented in Coming Home. And Tom Hayden was running for Senate. Jane Fonda was married to him then. So she went with him for a weekend, stumping California. And Hal and Rudy Wurlitzer, who he'd brought in to help us, along with Bob Jones, who was his writer, because when we started Coming Home, it was written by Waldo Salt. Waldo Salt had a stroke and was in an oxygen tent every day we made the movie. Bob Jones was Hal's editor. He had been in Vietnam. And so he moved Bob Jones up to writing the script, finishing the script, and getting it ready. And then Hal and him did that, and he brought in Donnie, what the hell's his name, to be his editor. And so we went on that way. And finally, when that weekend came, Hal said, I want to tell you how the movie's going to end. Because it didn't end at all like this in the script that we had been given originally. And the ending that you see in the movie is what he told me. So he said, here's what I want. I want you and Jane to start here. And then I want you to go in the ocean and take your life. Just go. And he said, and Haskell Wexler was in the room with me. And I said, okay. And Haskell had a little 8mm home movie camera, which is what that scene was shot on. Wow. And I said, how many feet do you have? You have a short end, or have you got 400 feet? He said, I got 220 feet. I said, oh, great. And Hal says, I want this done in a minute and 30 seconds. And I said, okay. Then he says to me, as a tape recorder, in his, he said, listen to this before you go out there. It's 5:40 in the morning at Hermosa Beach Pier in February. And he says, I want you to hear something. And over his tape recorder comes a guy on a two-string guitar singing the following. Once I was a soldier, I fought on foreign soil for you. Once I was a hunter, and I brought home fresh meat to you. And once I was your lover, and I looked beyond your eyes for you, I wonder, oh, how I wonder, will you ever remember me? Because soon there'll be another who will tell you I was just a lie. I wonder, will you ever me? Well, I got to go do the scene. I got tears in my eyes. That's not going to be part of the scene. And Hal has tears in his eyes. He said, 3 years ago, I was going to make a movie called Bound for Glory, which I meant. And I had this kid in there to read for the part, and I cast him. And the studio said no. The guy that was in there that he cast was Tim Buckley. And that's Tim Buckley's song from an album called No Man Can Find the War. And Once I Was a Soldier is one of the songs on it. And Tim Buckley died about 2 years after that, but before Coming Home. And he said to me, with his, you know, choked up and everything like that, I owe it to him. Now, I want you to do me a favor. Go out there and give me a Dernsey. Dernseys are things that I use to embroider whatever it is I'm doing.
And tell him who came up with that. Who told you that?
Well, Nicholson came up with that. I was in a little movie called Drive, he said, that he directed, and I walked down the hall, and two girls walked past me as a basketball coach, and there's nothing written in the script or anything. They walked by, they looked snappy, so I went, and he says, cut, that's it. That, folks, was a Dernsey. The man fills empty space with gems. So that was where it came from. So Hal said, I need a jersey. So I go to, a Dernsey. So I go to Haskell. And I say, stay with me. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to end up in the ocean. And he said, well, let me ask. I said, you don't ask Hal a fucking thing, man. Because Ann taught me I have one take, and that's the first take. Don't go up and ask permission from the director. He's got take 2 through 22. You have take 1. Where it can be spontaneous and work or not. Camera-wise, we'd worked it out. He was with me. We knew what was going to happen. I start out, and after about 10 steps, I realize instead of going right in, I'm going to the lifeguard stand. And I took off a dress blue Marine uniform, which Ann Roth, who was a costume designer, had never let me be in any scene or anything blue in the entire movie until that scene. So I take the uniform off, and I had done my hand a lot, so I couldn't get the wedding ring off. I finally get the wedding ring off, and I go in the water. I start swimming. Well, I don't hear good now. I have assistance, but then I couldn't hear anyway. I couldn't hear cut. I'm all the way out at the Redondo Beach Pier now. I'm turning over my shoulder. There's nobody in an outboard motorboat. There's nothing to do. I'm freezing. Finally, they send some lifeguard guy to get me. He brings me back in. And I walked on the beach, and Hal and the 8 other people, his real small crew, said, they were just destroyed. And that Monday, Jane came back from the weekend and said, what'd you guys do this weekend? Well, we messed around and did a couple scenes. Oh, well, I'm going to see it. Okay. So they showed her what we did. But how? We finished work that day about 7 o'clock Friday night. So Hal was with us all day long. And then he went up, and on coming home, Hal was a guy who would get a house way on the top of, way above Mulholland, on the top in Malibu, where he had a driveway a mile long, where he could see any sumbitch that was going to come up the driveway to look at his movie from United Artists. So he could always put a Bugs Bunny reel on or something like that. So in that 2 days, the man cut it. The man laid the music in it because he knew Jane had to like it. And they showed they showed it to her. And I had at that time a long history with Jane because we got in the actor's studio the same night in 1959. And she, me, and Ron Liebman, Ron Liebman is worst papa. She had a lot of plays and films that she could have done. I could never get a reading for it. And neither could Jack. This was 1959, 60, 61, 2, 3, so forth and so on. And she put her arms around me and she said, thank you guys for making my movie. The codicil to this is, the night of the Academy Awards, Coming Home wins the Academy Award for writing. Waldo Salt was okay. He went up. Bob Jones was okay. He went up. And then someone none of us had ever known went up. And that was a girl named Nancy Dowd, who had written Slapshot. And I think she won an award for it.
With her brother.
Yeah. And a week before, there was a lawsuit which she won. Because even though there wasn't a word of her thing in the script, she wrote a 270-page treatment for Jane Fonda called Buffalo Ghosts. And it was a triangular love story about Vietnam. And that's what all it was, what she was told to write. But no one ever showed it to us. And Jerry Hellman and Waldo Salt and the original director for Coming Home, who was John Schlesinger, had done 2 other movies together, 2 pretty good movies, Midnight Cowboy and Day of the Locust. And this was their third movie. So the folks could make movies, trust me. And so none of the three people on the stage had ever met the other one, but they all won the Academy Award.
Thanks to you, because again, so many of these characters you play, almost every character I can think of, every great performance, things I love, Laughing Policeman or Driving, these are all really proud guys you play. And that pride, sometimes misguided, sometimes heartbreaking as it was in Coming Home, because again, he's so proud that when he realizes that he has lost this woman, he has nothing left. Where does using pride in finding these characters come from for you?
Well, in this movie, you know, I had a director who put his money where his mouth was and did what he said he was going to do. He leaves the camera on you just long enough so you see the emotion start to develop. He doesn't cut before you see it start. The best shot I've ever seen of that in my career, I don't know, 55 years plus, is my old girlfriend in this movie coming out of the store at the end of the movie. I mean, the guy stays on her face because he knows, like we know, that's once upon a time. And she'd never had a film camera on her in her life before. She's an actress from Whittier. All three of the women in the movie are well into their 80s. I'm 77, June's 84. Mary Louise Wilson, who plays my sister-in-law in the movie, she won the Tony on Broadway 2 years ago because she was the mother in Grey Gardens. And then the third one was Angela. And it's just, that's what you know you have, and that's what's lucky about it. And so the toughest scene for me in the movie is going through the old house, because I come from a family of folks that did stuff. I've always been knocked out in my life by, you know, people that got stuff done. And I lived in a household that I tried to run from early on because it was political, but not political, because there were a lot of...
The McLeishes.
Yeah, the McLeishes and the Derns. And I had to raise my hand to be called on at my dinner table from 7 to 17 every night, because the kind of people that were at my dinner table were my father, my kind of so-called uncle, Adlai Stevenson, who ran for president twice, my uncle Archibald McLeish, who was a poet, five-time Pulitzer Prize winner.
And Kazan directed his play.
Kazan directed his play, J.B.
Oh, yeah, J.B. And my grandfather, Dern, who was gone by then, but he was the first non-Mormon governor of Utah and then Secretary of War in Roosevelt's first cabinet. And then there was Brucey. And Brucey was asked, what do you do after school? You know, now a guy like Stacy Keach would say, what do you do after school, guy? No, guy's out. I mean, I have a name. And they would just... I wasn't allowed to say anything, so I started embroidering. I invented Dernsies when I was 7, just to be fucking interesting. And to take a glove off. And finally, one day, at about 11 years old, I was really pissed off. And some of the other, what I would call the biggies, were not there. And so my uncle, Bruce McLeish, who was my father, I mean my grandfather, my mother's father, and Archie were brothers. And our family owned a department store in Chicago called Carson Peary Scott and Company. And the McLeishes were the end company of that store. And so they'd been around Chicago and Glencoe and Winnetka since 1878. And my grandfather and his other brother said, you know, Bruce, we went to school in Glencoe. I said, yeah, in the Pleistocene age. But... I'm not in the Pleistocene age, so how do we do things? He said, well, what do you like to do after school? Well, come on. They said, we know you skate. I was a pretty well-known, you know, speed skater. And then I started running. Or we know you run and everything. What else? I said, you know what I like to do? I got two or three friends. And you know what I like to do after school? We like to fuck shit up. They never got over that. I was sent to I was sent to camp every summer for 5 years, and I couldn't go to the local Wisconsin or Michigan camps. I had to go way to hell halfway up Hudson Bay, where all you did was take canoe trips, and for 21 days. And I was 9, and everybody else in the camp was 13, 14. But I had one neat thing happen. One day in August of my first year in camp, we were going across a lake in the dark with a full moon, one of those lakes that had all the burned out stumps on them, so when you go across it, it's trees were there, but they had a big fire, and then, well, you know, the water came and everything. And we were paddling along, and a guy in a canoe comes toward us, and he had like one of those old hunting Pendleton type shirts on. He pulled up next to, and I was in the first canoe, and he grabbed the gunwale, or whatever you call the side of the canoe, and our guide held the light up to his face, and he was kind of Quebecois, spoke some kind of thing, but he only said 3 words, and we hadn't seen a soul for 4 days, and he said, "The war is over." That was the day that the Japanese surrendered in 1945. And we were out of touch. We don't, you know, we were kids and counselors, but couldn't get things on the radio. There was no cell phones or anything like that. And those are the kind of things that I remember. I think the thing that I love most about what I've done in this business, what I've been involved with, and that I wished I saw more of now, when my generation got to New York or got here, we were lucky, Elvis, because we still got to work with the legends. We're not legends. Those people were legends because they were bigger than life.
Is that story you tell about being with Kazan and saying, "We're going to go see opera," and you watch the Luntz Fontanes go into the...
You gave it away, prick. One night, I'm sitting out, the first play I was ever in on Broadway was...
I'm just going to make some calls, Bruce. You just go ahead and do what you need to do.
Was called The Shadow of a Gunman, which was a Sean O'Casey play. And it was an Actor's Studio production, the first time they'd ever done anything on Broadway. And all of us in it were Actor's Studio members. And I'd just become a member. And... a director named Jack Garfine was directing the play for the first 17 days. The play was opening 8 days after that. Lee and Gadge walked into the rehearsal. There were 8 people in the play. His daughter Susan was one of the people, Susan Strasberg. And Lee said, Jack, what the hell is going on here? We were all still sitting at the table. Hadn't got up to try and mount the play anyway. And Jack said, "Well, we're still working on relationships." And Lee said, "Jack, go stand in the corner," basically. And he said to us, "You guys go take a break. Come back here in 2 hours. And I'll stage this, mother, by 4 o'clock this afternoon." Because we open on Broadway in 7 days. And the Actor's Studio can't be seen working at the table 8 days before anybody's been wardrobe, anything else. So to make a long story short, he stages the whole play between 1 and 4:30. Everybody knows what they're doing. And he did 2 classic things for me. The first one was, they'd seen me run a lot of races at Madison Square Garden when I was at Penn, and for the Penn track team. And by Madison Square, I mean they had indoor track meets, were big deal in the winter, back in the East particularly, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And they were relay carnivals. And they would go to them because they were both like sports a lot. And so the whole thing's... And Gadge stops Lee and he says, "Lee, you can't let him go for dinner." "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "You didn't..." And this now is 8 days later when the play's opening in 2 hours. We had the last rehearsal. And he said, "Lee, you forgot something." He said, "Oh, yes." Meaning every now and then Lee would give Gadge a little snide remark because Lee was from Russia, Gadge was from Turkey. And so he said, "What'd I forget?" He said, "You didn't stage a curtain call." And Lee said, "Oh my God, okay, well, you come out as soon as the curtain comes out. Then Bill Smithers, Gerald O'Loughlin, they were the 2 other actors, you come out, and then Susie, you come out last. two curtain calls, that's it. So they say, okay, we got it. You don't need to rehearse it now. Just, you know, make sure you do that tonight. Well, I raised my hand like a complete turd. And I said, he said, yes, runner man. I said, you didn't call my name. He said, that's exactly right. He said, you died in the play. I want when they go home in their cars or on the subway to be talking back and forth that you might have really died. So that was the first story. The second one, I used to sit outside the theater at about 7:20 before the show started at 8 o'clock. Every night I saw a scenario. And Gadge came out one night and he said, what are you sitting out here for? What is this? He said, the Knicks, you know, they don't start for another 20 minutes. So what are you worried about? This is 1958. And I said, you know what opera means to me. And I couldn't sit through an opera. But I love the opera of life. When you see collection of things happen that are opera. And the opening of the Olympic Games. Stuff like that. It's opera. So he says, really, what do you see? I said, you come tomorrow night at 7:18. He said, it better be fucking opera. So I'm sitting there. The next night, what I had seen, he sees. A big limousine pulls up into the alley between our little theater, the Bijou, and I forget the one next to it, Music Hall, maybe. And out of the front seat, a huge man gets out with a pink poodle in each arm. And he walks into the theater. A little lady gets out, maybe 4'11", out of the back seat, very frail, and walks into the theater with a poodle, pink poodle in each arm. I turn to Gadge, and he has tears flowing down his cheeks. And he says, it's opera. He said, and I'll never be a part of it as long as I live, no matter what I do, no matter how great I am, because that's the American theater, and they will never accept me on that level because the two people were Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontaine. And he felt somehow he'd never be on that level.
Well, he was wrong. And ladies and gentlemen, please, a living legend, Bruce Dern.
You've been listening to actor Bruce Dern in conversation with Elvis Mitchell as part of the Film Independent at LACMA screening series. The Treatment is produced by me, Jenny Rattlett, and mixed by Melissa Morton. Thanks to Film Independent for recording the interview. For more information on screenings and tickets, visit filmindependent.org/LACMA.